camping now, even campgrounds, you can't, you know, mm-hmm. you have to use a propane. I don't even know if you're allowed to use a propane, but it was, yeah, they're serious. They're not playing around with this firework stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, knock on wood that we'll be successful with preventing major forest fires this early in the year. So excited to have that. You know, the super soaker sounds fun. I haven't done that in a while. I guess if you're going to use water balloons, try to pick up the plasticky bits that you got. That seems important. Sometimes those are casualties as well, with sort of firework remnants on the ground. So, you know, just thinking about the impact on your environment, the impact on the people around you. We are coming right up on the end of our time here, so I want to thank everyone for listening. You've been listening to The Gap. I'm Althea. Tammy is here with me. We've been talking about Facebook and Facebook extremism, and then just now talking about what can we do instead of fireworks for this celebration.
Yes, we appreciate you calling in. Someone did say that maybe we can also wet the front yard and teach kids why fireworks are dangerous.
That's a great idea.
Yes. Thank you all for tuning in. Thank you very much. Coming up next is going to be Wings, and following that is Disability Justice. It's been a pleasure talking with y'all. Thank you so much, Althea.
Have a good weekend, everyone.
We'll see y'all. And don't forget, the Blues Festival is here on KBOO every day until Monday from 4 to noon. And here's some blues.
Yeah.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned natural foods cooperative featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and a farmer's market every Wednesday year-round. Located at Southeast Tibbet Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop.
Today on Wings, Green Women Farmers in India.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
This is Smita Ramanathan from Bangalore, India. Welcome to this edition of Wings Radio Show. I'm here in the studio with my colleague Manju Venkat and our sound engineer M.R. Ramamurthy.
Swami Sivanappana Poojagendu Baale Bagidavo.
You heard a song in the voice of Jayamma. She is a farmer from a village called Theruvidi near Bangalore. The song is a prayer to the local deity. The childless pray to be blessed with children. Devotees pray for the removal of infertility and poverty. Today's story is about a group of women like Jayamma from villages near Bangalore. These women are swimming against the tide. In India today, farming is no longer a feasible livelihood for millions of small and marginal farmers. Many of them are moving to the cities in search of livelihoods where they join the ranks of the unemployed and underemployed. In this context, the work of these farmers near a place called Kanakpura, 50 kilometers away from Bangalore, India's large metropolis, is significant. These women have resolutely held on to their lives and livelihoods in their villages. They belong to an organization called Green Foundation. Their mission? They continue to practice farming as in the olden days, the days before the Green Revolution. They use indigenous seeds and organic inputs.
A brief background of the Green Revolution in India. This agricultural movement was started in the early 60s in response to food shortages and famines in India, which impoverished millions. To increase food production and productivity, the Indian government approached scientists in India and abroad for help. This led to the development of hybrid varieties of wheat and rice and the introduction of synthetic fertilizers, pesticides, and chemicals. Food production did increase. What it also did was pave the way for entry of large commercial seed and chemical manufacturers. It standardized and homogenized agriculture. What we lost as a result was our vast diversity in agriculture. It is this loss that organizations like Green Foundation are trying to reverse. We spoke to a few of the farmers working with the foundation near Kanakapura. In Bangalore, we also spoke to Vanaja Ramprasad, the founder of the organization. Vanaja has been working in this field for about 40 years. Let us hear from her on how it all started.
When I had moved into Bangalore and I was looking for a job, I felt the kind of job I'd like to be involved in, it should be something that gives back to the society. So I went to work in a hospital outreach program. And so I used to go with their team into the villages. And we used to see a lot of children. They were neighboring areas with a lot of quarries. And the women were working as stone breakers. And then their children were so malnourished. It was a typical case of kwashiorkor and marasmus. So they used to bring these children to the hospital. And they used to be fed with the American milk powder. So the recovery was very fast because the milk powder has high protein. And I heard gory stories like where the mothers used to give them alcohol to make them sleep. And they'll go to work. And then naturally they are taken off the breast. And then they are not given enough formulas. So the minute they go back, the children will go into remission and they'll come back in the worst situation.
As part of the rehabilitation program, the children were then fed locally available food. The mothers were trained how to prepare these foods. However, they were so poor, they could not continue to do that when they went back home. This set Vanaja thinking.
Then it made me think, this is only a temporary measure. But if we have to go down to the root, then we have to understand. At that time, it was the peak of Green Revolution. India was producing a lot of food and our granaries were overflowing. So it is quite an anomaly to think, on the one hand we have so much food, on the other hand there's so much of malnutrition and poverty.
Vanaja went back to school to get an academic perspective of the problem. To understand the field situation, she also travelled across India to talk to farmers. This is what she learned from her travels. She says,
A striking thing that came out was that in Green Revolution, there was complete change in the way people cultivated and what they cultivated. It was all monocultures. The diversity that India could have boasted of was all lost. Because India has fantastic agroecological zones. It has high rainfall, semi-arid, desert, and then rain-fed areas. Like this, across the country, the agroecological zones were so different. During the Green Revolution, the market only was for rice and wheat. So the farmers had stopped growing millets. Everybody just jumped into rice and wheat. And that too, the diversity in rice and wheat also narrowed down. See, the scientists started talking about productivity. Productivity was only per acre, this many kilos of rice or wheat. But they did not take into account what nutrition people got and what is the insurance against failure of crop.
Vanaja felt that merely trying to increase food production would not eradicate hunger. That was like treating the symptoms of the disease and not the cause of the disease itself. She felt that she had to go back to the villages, work with farmers and tap into their wisdom to get to the root of the problem. She raised resources for buying some farmland near Kanakapura. When she started work there in 1990s, literacy levels were low. urbanization had yet to come to Kanakpura. When the foundation started work in this area, farmers had already started using hybrid varieties of seeds and were using synthetic fertilizers. Sumati, a farmer from Maralwadi village, says that they believed the myth that use of synthetic inputs was the only way to get a good yield. Let us listen to her.
ಅದು ಒಂದು ಭ್ರಮೆ ಆಗ್ಬಿಟ್ಟಿದೆ ಇಲ್ಲಿ ರೈತರುಗಳಿಗೆ. ಅದು ಇನ್ಆರ್ಗ್ಯಾನಿಕ್ ಗೊಬ್ಬರ ಹಾಕಿದ್ರೇನೆ ಬೆಳೆ ಬರೋದು, ಅದು ಹುಟ್ಟೋದು, ಅದು ಗೊಬ್ಬರ ಹಾಕಿದ್ರೇನೆ ಅದು ಮೊಳಕೆ ಬರೋದು ಅನ್ನೋ ಒಂದು ಭ್ರಮೆ ಆಗ್ಬಿಟ್ಟಿದೆ.
ದ ಗ್ರೀನ್ ಫೌಂಡೇಶನ್ ಬಿಗ್ಯಾನ್ ಇಟ್ಸ್ ವರ್ಕ್ ಬೈ ಆರ್ಗನೈಸಿಂಗ್ ಸೀಡ್ ಫೆಸ್ಟಿವಲ್ಸ್ ಕಾಲ್ಡ್ ಬೀಜ ಮೇಳಾಸ್ ಇನ್ ದ ಲೋಕಲ್ ಲ್ಯಾಂಗ್ವೇಜ್. ವನಜಾ ಟಾಕ್ಸ್ ಅಬೌಟ್ ದಿ ಅರ್ಲಿ ಡೇಸ್ ಆಫ್ ದಿಸ್ ವರ್ಕ್.
So we used to organize Bij Melas. So asking the farmers to bring whatever original seeds that they have to bring it to this Mela. Mm. And then reward the person who has kept a lot of. So this was an incentive. Mm-hmm. And then there were just five women who cooperated and came into it. And then a small cow shed we started. Mm. Multiplying this small quantities of seeds. Mm. So at that time people were laughing at us. What are you going to do with small quantities when our requirements are so huge? Mm. The same people now, see the kind of importance that is there for the seeds. And slowly from 5 grams to 50 grams, 50 grams to 5 kilos, like that, it kept on multiplying.
She went on to explain how international research institutes introduced hybrid rice and wheat varieties to India. These were new to the Indian ecosystem and attracted a lot of pests. She also talked about the politics behind such research.
In the 70s, I saw a fantastic film called The September Wheat, which said about wheat that is being made into high-yielding varieties and hybrid varieties in United States. And there was so much wheat, they didn't know what to do with it. Mm. They wanted to send it to war-torn areas and countries like ours. Mm. And the other thing was that they gave subsidy to farmers in the United States not to grow, because there's so much surplus. Mm. Now they didn't know how to deal with it. Mm. So one of their politicians looks at the granary and says, this is more powerful than our weapons in the war. Mm. Food. You can keep people in your clutches, yes, with the control of food. So that is how the whole story of Green Revolution started. Mm. In fact, we have done comparison between high yield variety and the indigenous variety. Mm. How much they spend, how much is their yield. Mm. In spite of all that, see, the yield will be a little less in the indigenous varieties. Mm. But they'll be spending more. Anyway, it was more men who wanted to grow the high yielding varieties, take it to the market, and they were lured by the money. Yeah. Mm. So in the case of finger millet, we found the volume of high yielding varieties was a lot more. Mm. So, when they take it to the market, they will be able to sell it by bags. Mm-hmm. But whereas, when the indigenous varieties are grown, they are filled. They are not. There will be less in volume, but more in weight. And the flavor, we have conducted many participatory varietal selections, mm-hmm, with farmers. And when they rate the different crops, they'll give a very high rating for the indigenous crops. Mm-hmm. Because in the indigenous, they have high fodder quality, mm-hmm, high cooking quality, yeah, the taste is much better, and the aroma is much better. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the high-yielding varieties, the quantity may be more, but all these, they'll rank very low.
Sumati, one of the farmers that we spoke to near Kanakpura, talks of her experience with growing organic produce.
ಆರ್ಗ್ಯಾನಿಕ್ ಅಲ್ಲಿ ಬೆಳೆದಿರೋಂಥದ್ದು, ಇದು ಕೆಮಿಕಲ್ ಹಾಕಿ ಬೆಳೆದಿರೋಂಥದ್ದು ಹೆಸರು ಕಾಳನ್ನು ನಾನು ಉಪಯೋಗಿಸಿದ್ದೀನಿ. ಅದು ಟೇಸ್ಟಿಗೂ, ನಾವು ಸಾವಯವದಲ್ಲಿ ಬೆಳೆದಿರೋ ಹೆಸರು ಕಾಳು ಟೇಸ್ಟಿಗೂ ತುಂಬ ವ್ಯತ್ಯಾಸ ಇದೆ. ಅದರಲ್ಲಿ ಸ್ವಲ್ಪ ಇದು ಬರುತ್ತೆ, ಸ್ಮೆಲ್ ಬರುತ್ತೆ.
ಸುಮತಿ ಸೆಟ್, that the green gram that she grows using indigenous seeds and organic inputs is much tastier. The other crop had a particular odor, which the organic one does not. I asked her how she copes with the loss in income, which is caused by lower yields. She said that though the yield comes down, there is no real loss, as the quality of the crop is better and the cost of input is less. She also finds that organically grown grains are heavier. As a result, one needs to consume less of it to appease one's hunger. She says that on careful observation, this is better for health and so is no loss at all.
Let us listen to Vanaja talk about the importance of using indigenous seeds.
We have found when this kind of climate change is there, the rains are delayed. But sowing would have already taken place. So the high-yielding varieties will just wither away. Whereas the indigenous varieties will start coming up with the rain. And then we also felt that there was an overarching political reason why the high-yielding varieties and hybrid varieties were being promoted. Because it is the companies which are going to take control of food. And the same companies also started manufacturing the chemicals that were needed. So it's coming as a package to the farmers.
In our discussion, I mentioned the book The World According to Monsanto by Marie Monique Robinson. She writes that Monsanto, which is today a seed supplier to the world, started out as a company manufacturing coolants and lubricants. These very companies also control much of the research that takes place in agriculture. I asked Vanaja if it is true that most seed producing companies are also manufacturing chemicals.
Correct.
Right? And now they are a seed company.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And they are also producing all these glyphosate resistant varieties and so many other things, Roundup and all those things. So this that's why we wanted to focus on policy matters also.
Policies related to agriculture in India are actually a mixed bag. India is one of the first countries to have legislation to protect farmers' rights. The Protection of Plant Varieties and Farmers' Rights Act seeks to protect rights of both farmers and breeders. Breeders are seed manufacturing companies, and the act was initially a result of demand from them. Clauses to protect rights of farmers were added as a result of pressure from civil society. India's Biological Diversity Act stipulates that benefits from the use of traditional biological resources and knowledge must be shared equitably. However, in reality, this does not happen. Scientists and companies take traditional knowledge and resources and use patent laws and other means to make proprietary products. This is then delivered back at a heavy price. It is in this context that the Green Foundation works on the concept of food sovereignty.
See, there's a big difference between food security and food sovereignty. See, food sovereignty means farmers who produce food must have control over their food. Whereas food security is only you are reaching out through this PDS, through midday meal schemes. You are trying to, you know, cover up the lack of food for the people. Whereas food sovereignty includes sovereignty over seeds, all the inputs that are needed for their agriculture, land. So many people in India don't have land. They are landless and they are lease out land. So the patta is not even in their names. And women don't have the title. So with all this, I think there's a long way to go before we reach that situation of food sovereignty.
PDS that Vanaja mentioned is the public distribution system, and the midday meal scheme is run in schools. These are food security programs of the Indian government. The seed bank run by the women farmers in Kanakpura is one small step towards food sovereignty. It started out 12 years ago as a bank where farmers exchange seeds. Today it has grown into a small enterprise. Mahadeshwara Seed Producers Group is run by a group of 10 women. Each woman invested $16 as working capital. They were provided grants by the Green Foundation and the government, which helped them secure assets such as a building and storage facilities. They procure good quality indigenous seeds from farmers and sell it locally. The seeds are preserved using natural materials and they do the germination test before selling. They also produce organic inputs and vegetable seeds. Let us listen to Vijaya Kumari, the secretary of the group, talk about the seed bank.
ಮುಂದೆ ಬೀಜ ಬೇಕು ಅಂದಿದ್ರೆ ಹೊರಗಡೆ ಹೋಗ್ಬೇಕಾಗಿತ್ತು ತರಲಿಕ್ಕೆ. ಈಗ ಬೀಜ ಬ್ಯಾಂಕ್ ಆಗಿರೋದಿಸೆ ಹೊರಗಡೆ ಹೋಗುವಂಥದ್ದು ಏನಿಲ್ಲ, ಇಲ್ಲೇ ಸಿಗುತ್ತೆ. ಒಟ್ಟಲ್ಲಿ ರೈತರುಗಳು ಎಲ್ಲ ತಂದು ಇಲ್ಲಿ ಇಟ್ಕೊಂಡಿರ್ತೀವಿ, ಇಲ್ಲಿಂದ ತಿರ್ಗಿ ರೈತರುಗಳು ತಗೊಂಡೋಗ್ತಾರೆ ಅಂತ ಬೇರೆ ಬಿತ್ತನೆ ಕಾಲ ಬಂತು ಅಂದರೆ.
ವಿಜಯಕುಮಾರಿ ಸೇಸ್ ದಟ್ ಬಿಫೋರ್ ದ ಸೀಡ್ ಬ್ಯಾಂಕ್ ವಾಸ್ ಎಸ್ಟಾಬ್ಲಿಷ್ಡ್, ಫಾರ್ಮರ್ಸ್ ಹ್ಯಾಡ್ ಟು ವಿಸಿಟ್ ಮೆನಿ ಮಾರ್ಕೆಟ್ಸ್ ನಿಯರ್ ಅಂಡ್ ಫಾರ್ ಟು ಬೈ ಸೀಡ್ಸ್. ನೌ ದೇ ಕ್ಯಾನ್ ಬೈ ಇಟ್ ಆಟ್ ದೇರ್ ಡೋರ್ ಸ್ಟೆಪ್. Since the bank knows of their requirements, they can be assured of getting what they want. She went on to add that there is now a demand for these seeds as farmers have realized that grains grown from indigenous seeds have higher nutrient content.
Many farmers are aware of the better quality of indigenous plant varieties and their role in combating hunger. However, governments and research institutes continue to press for high-end technology to increase production and productivity to feed the growing population. The kind of research done by small farmers hardly attracts any funding or attention. In her book, Living on the Edge, Women, Agrobiodiversity and Livelihood, Vanaja talks about the need for gender-sensitive research. We asked her to give examples of such research.
Like for example, you are only doing on increasing the production, but you are not looking at a multi-cropping system, how it provides nutrition to the whole family, and also the type of crops that the women would like to grow for festivals, for special needs, for the children. And another thing is, like, we found an old woman. We asked her, what are the kind of, things that you collect from your field during the rainy season? She brought about 70 or 80 different weeds, what we call as weeds. But it was not weeds for them. So we think that we need to kill all the weeds with the weedicides and insecticides. Whereas they have value for them. It is ethno-veterinary, it is for children's illness, they make something. Also, a lot of food for themselves. So, they need to collect things like that. So, whatever research is being done should be able to. Now, of course, international organizations are talking about underutilized plants and this and that. So, when an international organization talks, there is a response. Whereas, we don't listen to the people who are in the field.
Green Foundation also talks about the need for gender-sensitive policy. Let us listen to Vanaja talk about this.
Why did women give up growing millets? Because it needed a lot of hard work. So, policy should be there to develop some mechanization, which, of course, now it has come. So, kind of mechanical devices that are needed to reduce the load of for women should be developed. Schools for girl children, which is close by, and good education for them. It is good if they are educated also, because we find what is lacking is in these enterprises, women's financial literacy is very low. So how do we bring up their awareness about financial literacy? How much they are spending, how much they are earning. They need to know because they have invested money in it. So there should be a policy to help women in these areas.
Sarva Mangala from the Mahadeshwara Seed Producers Group talks of how machinery has reduced women's drudgery in the home.
ಚಟ್ನಿ ರುಬ್ಬೋದಿಲ್ಲ, ಎಲ್ಲ ಮಿಷಿನ್ಗೆ ತಗೊಂಡೋಗ್ತೀವಿ. ಮಿಷಿನಿಂದ ರಾಗಿ ಎಲ್ಲ ಕ್ಲೀನ್ ಮಾಡ್ಕೊಂಡು ಅಸೆಟ್ ಮಾಡ್ತಾ ಬಂದಿರ್ತೀವಿ. ಮನೆಯಲ್ಲಿ ರುಬ್ಬಬೇಕು ಅಂದ್ರೆ ಮಿಕ್ಸಿಗೆ
ಸುತ್ತಿ ಹಾಕ್ಬಿಟ್ರೆ ಅಂದ್ರೆ ಆಗೋಯ್ತಿಲ್ಲ
ಅಷ್ಟೇ.
ಶಿ ಸೇಸ್ ದಟ್ ದ ಯೂಸ್ ಆಫ್ ಅಪ್ಲಾಯನ್ಸಸ್ ಲೈಕ್ ಮಿಕ್ಸೀಸ್ ಅಂಡ್ ಗ್ರೈಂಡರ್ಸ್ ಇನ್ ದ ಕಿಚನ್ ಹ್ಯಾಸ್ ಗ್ರೇಟ್ಲಿ ರಿಡ್ಯೂಸ್ಡ್ ವುಮೆನ್ಸ್ ಡೈಲಿ ಟಾಯ್ಲ್. ದೇ ಆರ್ ಆಲ್ಸೋ ಓಪನ್ ಟು ದ ಯೂಸ್ ಆಫ್ ನ್ಯೂ ಟೆಕ್ನಾಲಜಿ ಟು ರಿಡ್ಯೂಸ್ ದೇರ್ ಡ್ರಜರಿ ಇನ್ ದ ಫೀಲ್ಡ್ಸ್.
Today, many Indian farmers are moving to the cities to eke out a living. The Green Foundation is making an attempt to promote agriculture-based enterprises in the villages where it works so that farmers can realize better incomes. This is what Vanaja has to say.
Why are farmers attracted to the city? They are looking for jobs. Mm-hmm. And they are attracted by this whole thing of In the night through, you have
lifestyle
and lights and all that. See, no person would like to leave their land, leave their home and come into a city like this and then live in a slum.
Yes.
There is also reverse migration taking place.
Okay.
Because of all the problems that are there in the cities. So we are hoping that by creating livelihoods, the farmers will continue to find it useful to stay in the villages.
An important part of promoting livelihoods is the establishment of a farmers' federation called the Janadhanya. Janadhanya means people's grains. Green Foundation works in nearly 200 villages around Kanakapura. Farmers in these villages have conserved more than 360 varieties of indigenous cereals, pulses and vegetables. This includes more than 50 varieties of finger millet and 36 varieties of paddy. Janadhanya serves as the marketing arm for these enterprises. They purchase products from these farmers and sell them locally as well as in Bangalore, where there is a growing demand for organic produce. You heard the organic farmer Sumati talk at the beginning of this show. She heads the Sri Maruti Oil Producers Group in her village of Maralwadi. They produce organically grown seeds such as sesame and coconut and extract oil using a cold press. They sell to the Janadhanya as well, offer their services to local farmers wanting to extract oil.
The Annapurneshwari Finger Millet Producers Group in Marasarahalli village has 13 members. They run a millet grinding unit. They produce flour from organically grown finger millet and sell it to Janadhanya. Ratnamma, a member of this group, talks of their enterprise.
ಈ ಕೊಟ್ಟಿಗೆ ಗೊಬ್ಬರ ಹಾಕಿ ರಾಗಿ ಮಾಡ್ತಾರೋ ಅವ್ರು ರಾಗಿ ತಗೊಳ್ಳೋದು ನಾವೇನೆ ಪರ್ಚೇಸ್ ಮಾಡಿ ರಾಗಿ ತಂದು ತಿರ್ಗಾ ಇವಾಗ ಜನಧಾನ್ಯಕ್ಕೆ ನಾವು ಅವು ಆರ್ಡ್ರ್ ಬಂದಾಗ ಕೊಟ್ಟು ಕಳಿಸೋದು, ಆಮೇಲೆ ಅದರಲ್ಲಿ ರಾಗಿ ಪೌಡ್ರ್ ಮಾಡೋದು.
ರತ್ನಮ್ಮ ಸೇಸ್ ದಟ್ ದೇ ಬೈ ಆರ್ಗ್ಯಾನಿಕ್ ಫಿಂಗರ್ ಮಿಲೆಟ್ ಫ್ರಮ್ ಫಾರ್ಮರ್ಸ್ ಅಂಡ್ ಸೆಲ್ ದ ಫ್ಲಾ ಟು ಜನಧಾನ್ಯ. ದೇ ಆಲ್ಸೋ ಮೇಕ್ ವ್ಯಾಲ್ಯೂ ಆಡೆಡ್ ಪ್ರಾಡಕ್ಟ್ಸ್ ಸಚ್ ಎಸ್ ಫ್ಲಾ ಫ್ರಮ್ ಸ್ಪ್ರೌಟೆಡ್ ಮಿಲೆಟ್ಸ್ ಅಂಡ್ ಸ್ಪೆಷಲ್ ಫ್ಲಾ ಫಾರ್ ಪ್ಯಾನ್ಕೇಕ್ಸ್.
ಗ್ರೀನ್ ಫೌಂಡೇಶನ್ಸ್ ಫೀಲ್ಡ್ ಮ್ಯಾನೇಜರ್ Shankarappa told us that there are more than 15 farmer producer groups in the villages around Kanakapura. They are all linked to Janadhanya. They have become stakeholders by purchasing shares in the federation. The Janadhanya Federation is therefore accountable to these farmers.
Listening to these women, I couldn't help wonder, how is it that they are able to hold out against such mighty forces? The huge corporations, the pull of the city, not so favorable laws. Sarvamangala, a member of the seed producers group, said that as long as they are alive, they will keep the movement going. She is not sure if the next generation will follow their example, but thinks that it is an example worth setting nevertheless. She also feels that women are more likely to keep this going rather than men.
As we left the seed producers group in Therubidi, Jayamma's song continued to ring in my ears. I pray with her that hunger and poverty may indeed be removed from our land. This is Manju Venkat saying goodbye from Bangalore, India, with Smita Ramanathan and M.R. Ramamurthy. Thank you for listening.
Yella magane madibatte taralilla olmeti swami tarutini baale bagidavo.
To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or find Wings Radio on Facebook. Wings loves our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Lee Bana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Good morning. This is Disability Justice, an everyday pursuit and survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
And Dina Wilder, board operator.
Good morning. Today I have Nicole Hammerquist with me, who is a DSP. And yeah, good morning, Nicole.
Good morning, John.
So, Nicole, what do DSPs do?
A DSP is a caregiver. It stands for Direct Service Provider. And it's there's many different titles for caregivers. Like when I am in the shoes of a direct service provider, I work for the brokerages, which means that I'm working for the intellectual disabilities community. When I'm working with more physically disabled people, I am a home care worker through the county, through Multnomah County, through the SEIU union. And so it's kind of very confusing, and it separates these communities in these arbitrary ways sometimes.
And when you say sets them in arbitrary ways, you mean it's kind of like setting the intellectually disabled community over here and the physically disabled community over here, rather than just saying they may have overlapping needs. Why not just combine them together?
Right. And if we're making these individualized care plans, then why couldn't that, those differences be represented in those care plans and in the services they receive?
Probably an attempt by the government to keep us at each other's throats rather than concentrating on the stupidity in the bureaucracy.
Yeah, I don't love bureaucracy or paperwork. It's not my strong suit.
Yeah. See, so I was wondering, how would your duties differ from, I mean, if you're taking physical care of somebody versus their intellectual care, is there a different set of trainings for the DSP than there is for the home care workers?
So DSP is run through a small business person. So I think it varies vastly based on who is employing the DSP. Home care worker is through the county and the state. And so it's like everything is the same kind of. And they are implementing some new trainings that we will start doing. But most of my training came from college because I have a bachelor's in social work. So I'm like overqualified, very overqualified for this.
Wow, a bachelor's in social work. So they must pay you quite a little bit of money.
There's no like education requirement for the position I hold.
Oh, so they don't pay you a whole lot of money?
I mean, the wage is a little bit more than minimum or than $15 an hour, because we do have the SEIU advocating for us. and people like John advocating for us.
And when you say, so when you say SEIU, that's advocating for you on the home care and PSW side, but not necessarily on the DSP side, right?
Not necessarily, but I think that the more that politicians become aware of just disabled people's needs, the more services they'll get. So it probably helps both sides.
I was just kind of curious of that because I am aware that they had a bill in the House to increase the wages for DSPs to 150% of minimum wage, and yet it was defeated, which does seem to indicate that they really don't understand our needs, because if they did understand our needs, well, then they get in and they, like, you know, fund our DSPs or PSWs and our home care workers greater than minimum wage, which, you know, would help us hold on to the workers who are sometimes saving our lives, you know, and instead of constantly de-evaluate or, you know, valuing them and giving them a living wage.
So when we go to Salem to advocate, something I've noticed is, like, it'll be Dairy Farmer Day, and the dairy farmers will be giving out free cheese and ice cream and yogurt to everybody. You know, when we go to advocate for disabled people, we don't have any goodies to give to anybody. We just have needs, and it's not as flashy and exciting, and there's not a big cash flow in it for the politicians. And so it's pretty discouraging, you know. And so it's great that SEIU exists to advocate for us as employees. But yeah, the little guy gets swept under the rug. It can be very discouraging.
And would you say that a lot, that some of this might be because we still live in a white male only world in the United States, and because caregiving is often a female predominantly, or, you know, there's mostly females in this profession, so they're definitely undervalued, and so that's probably why they don't give you all the wage you need and the benefits you need?
I would definitely say that caring is undervalued. You know, our last president didn't help with that at all. It's not cool to care. And especially during the pandemic, it's not easy to care.
Well, I mean, during the pandemic, you would think that's when they give you the most money, because you all are going to people's homes and kind of endangering the loved ones and everything else like that.
Yeah, I did get some assistance. And I heard that this last stimulus bill that passed had some special stuff set aside for caregivers. And I'm hoping that'll eventually get into my pocket. It hasn't yet. But I definitely, you know, and being a social worker, or, you know, having that background, I know where to find the resources and was able to get some assistance that way as well. But yeah, it would be nice if I didn't have to be crafty and clever to get paid a reasonable amount. And even then, I don't really get paid a reasonable amount. But I was very happy to have an employment, to be able to continue having a paycheck through the pandemic. It made me grateful to be in this field during this time.
Well, wouldn't you say that it'd be awfully nice if, you know, the state, who essentially gives you the money, would value you enough to give you a reasonable living wage with benefits that help keep you healthy and help out with your business expenditures?
Yeah, it would be nice to have a, well, yeah. I mean, the biggest thing for me right now is I want to be able to buy a house, and, you know, I make plenty of money to be able to pay my portion of a mortgage if I shared it with others, and live a happy life. But I don't make enough to get a mortgage. Like, the number that I bring home isn't enough. And so I'm going to have to leave caregiving to be able to make enough to go buy a house.
So it is, you would say, like, I mean, if you had to live on your own and you didn't have roommates, could you say you could live on what you make?
No, probably not.
So Nicole, you're a person who likes free stuff and you've got the skills to find the free stuff. But if you didn't have those skills, wouldn't you say this could be a business that could be difficult to make a living at?
Yeah, if I deserve to have nice stuff in life, I don't have to, I shouldn't have to just settle for whatever I can get. Yeah. And sometimes it's hard to remember that.
Yeah, I mean, it would be nice to give you proper value for all that education you went through.
Yeah.
So, Nicole, I'm a little curious about how you got into this business. Do you mind telling us your story?
Yeah, I had a mentor who had a master's in social work and was a director of nonprofits, kind of doing the nonprofit track of social work world. And then I, you know, had to go to community college, take prereqs, and then got into the school. And by the time I got to the end of my education track, this mentor was making 60K as a director of a YWCA in her 60s and was working, you know, quote unquote part-time, but actually working way more than 40 hours a week. And I'd have ruled out that I probably didn't want to be a hospital social worker. I don't think I'm mental health counselor material. And so I kind of like am sitting there with this bachelor's degree looking at another, I think it was, I would have gotten a deal on a master's degree, probably another $80,000 in debt to get a master's degree. And I'm like, well, I'm not actually, didn't feel very confident I was going to be able to make a return on finishing the track to become a master's in social work. So I continued working in restaurants. Then I got a job working in group homes and mental health. And then I was like, oh yeah, group homes are terrible. I'm never working in a group home again. And then I went back to restaurants, and then I got a job supported living apartments as a 24-hour like on-call crisis person, and also just teaching life skills. I've taught a lot of cooking classes. Then all of those programs got shut down, first in Multnomah County, and then I got moved to Clackamas County. It was like 2016. And then there was literally one supported living mental health apartment building in the Tri-County area. And so I was like, well, I can't work in that sector anymore. And then my good friend who is a elderly guy with cerebral palsy talked me into working for him. And then it's been about 3 years since I started caregiving, and I've learned a lot. And I don't know, it's nice to be more independent and work more directly with the client. And sometimes I wish I had the supervision I did when I was working, you know, with a team, more like with a team.
But working for the small provider orgs, don't you have like, I don't know, some way of communicating with like the boss of the provider org and getting some support from them when needed?
The owner I work for as a DSP is available. But, you know, it's like, it's rare that I see my coworkers because it's so like, nobody can work at the same time.
Uh-huh.
It's a little bit isolating, but at the same time, I am sometimes in assisted living facilities and I see how weird their coworker dynamics are, and I don't miss that. As our friend Glenna likes to say, home care working is kind of like the wild, wild west of the caregiving world. You know, you're kind of out there on your own. And your clients are often very, I mean, client people understand stuff, and, you know, I got to keep up.
Thanks for giving us that insight into, you know, what it's like to be a caregiver, you know, especially that insight of the wild, wild west. I think that's a good example to use to connect with. So, Nicole, do you like your job?
I do, yeah. I could see myself doing this kind of work, you know, maybe switching up my clients here and there for a long time. But unfortunately, you know, the benefits are decent.
And when you say they're decent, are they decent on the home care worker side, or are they decent on the DSP side?
The home care worker side, which is part of the reason I have to do both. I have to do a lot of juggling for my job to work, for me to get the best wage and the best benefits that I can. But even no matter how much juggling I do, I can't make enough to buy a house. So I'm gonna have to, I'm like looking at maybe driving a bus. I don't know, I'm looking at something else that I can do long enough to get a mortgage. And then, like, I imagine myself possibly coming back to home care or caregiving. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know. But once I change my path, I don't know if that's where, if it'll lead me back to it or not.
And I'd like to point out that, I mean, you know, I've always found you to be kind of crafty and skillful and kind of frugal with your money. Frugal, I hope I got that term correct. And, you know, kind of clever in how you find things and get things and stuff like that. Very resourceful. I keep on calling you the resource queen.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah. And so, I mean, you know, somebody else who doesn't know how to work the system like you do probably doesn't have like the pay and the benefits you do. Wouldn't you say that'd be true?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I mean, but I did the same track where I started working for a caregiving organization, which is another, you know, job that I've had that we didn't talk about. That's also part of the caregiving world, where you have, there's a larger organization coordinating the care. So it's better for the person receiving the care, because they're guaranteed, like, if I get sick, there's somebody to cover my shift.
Uh-huh.
So there's a lot of benefits to the client for that, but I'm pretty sure the employees make like $3 to $4 less per hour than I do.
And when you say, but that isn't, when you say 24-hour care, that really isn't what a DSP does, right?
Not 24-hour care, but they have coverage. With the caregiving organization, the care can go up to 24 hours. Yeah, some people do receive 24-hour care. But, there's a lot of different ways to receive care.
Yes, from what I understand, and you can correct me if I've got any of this wrong, home care workers generally deal with people with disabilities, just physical disabilities. There are two people who deal with people who have intellectual disabilities, that's the DSPs and PSWs. Mm-hmm. And then there's within that whole system, which is really confusing. There's There's the one-on-one service that people would get with you as a DSP for a few hours. And then there's, like, isn't there one that gives out, like, the 24-hour care? You live in your own home, but you get the 24-hour care, and you don't have to worry about talking to any company and making sure that there's somebody coming in.
Yeah. I
remember that what that's called.
Yeah, you know, I think it's like caregiving organizations. Yeah.
And then there's like adult foster care. There's group homes. And then, of course, I like to think of this as different than anybody else. And that's what I call LARCH.
Well, there's also like assisted living.
Oh, yeah, and assisted living. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, but there's something that I noticed was, so I was working, I've been in and out of a facility, like one of my jobs is in a facility. I don't work for the organization, but like there was issues with wearing masks. And so I did some research, and I also like overheard one of the ombudsman's meetings, and it's like, you can't, there's like, reporting is so weird. Like some of these, it's like not, I don't know. There's so many different nooks and crannies and different ways to do caregiving that it gets really confusing. Like, oh, who's watching out for these people? Are their concerns going to be heard by the, is it mandatory reporting? Like, are they actually protected under like are the concerns just going to get funneled into OSHA? Like, oh, it's just a safety, workplace safety concern. Like,
yeah, I know that all caregivers are required mandatory reporters, but
right. Yeah, but with the pandemic, it's like, you know, like the masks, it was like, I guess it's not like obvious abuse, but yeah, I don't know. I just think so I know somebody who lives in a assisted living home right now, who has been in their room for on lockdown in their room for 3 weeks and is going to be for 4 weeks because somebody tested positive for COVID 3 weeks ago. And it was probably because they are not requiring their employees to be vaccinated. Like, I don't think anyone in the US can require people to be vaccinated. It's wild.
Wow. Okay. That seems like prison to me. I mean, yeah, that seems bad to me. So Nicole, where do you see your future going?
Well, I definitely see myself having to get a different job for at least 3 years, 2 to 3 years. And I don't know if that's going to be something that has a larger career path that I decide I want to follow, or if I just decide that I liked caregiving and I want to go back to caregiving. But I will have to change my line of work for a while and probably change up my clients, which it's really overwhelming to think about that because I have 5 clients. And so, and I care about all of them and I don't want to like let them down or disrupt their lives. And so it's a really frustrating place to be in.
Well, that is often how it works in this industry because, you know, it's for some unknown reason, both at the federal, state, county, and city level, people are unwilling to make caregiving a profession in which people can stay in their entire life, get a living wage, get the benefits they need, and the benefits that would attract future caregivers. And the clients are ultimately the ones who suffer for it. And we can't seem to get across to our politicians in any way, shape, or form. So, I mean, it really sucks that we have to lose good caregivers like you because, you know, you want what everybody else wants in life and you can't get it by being in this profession that won't give you what you need to stay in it.
Yeah.
And that really sucks, not only for caregivers who really like being a caregiver, but also for clients who really need good caregivers. So yeah, I mean, that's really bad to hear that you gotta kind of move on from this. And people like me, and hopefully the union, which is SEIU Local 503, will continue to fight to end the ODD coalition will continue to fight for all the home care workers, the PSWs, and the DSPs to make sure that they get what they need so that we can hold on to you all. And the self-advocates, of course, will continue to fight. And, you know, when you do step out of this field, hopefully you will step into a field that is now a profession in the future. Hopefully we get that real soon, though. I want to thank you for coming into the studio and, you know, sitting down and talking to me and tell me about DSPs and their struggles and tell me about some of your own personal struggles and stuff. Thanks for doing this interview, Nicole.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, John.
I hope to see you in the future. I hope to see you again here on my show.
Justice.
Yeah, disability justice and everyday pursuit in survival. And holding on to our caregivers is a reason why it's an everyday pursuit in survival.
I'm going to read to you from the DD Coalition's Go Bulletin from the 2021 Legislative Investments in DD Services. On Saturday, June 26th, we saw the legislature wrap up this long and fruitful legislative session. We are thrilled to see much needed investment in direct support professional wages during this legislative session. This additional funding will be a tremendous support for an area of our system that has been experiencing a staffing crisis for years. The legislature has done two things to create historic investment in direct support professional wages. Starting July 1st, 2021, DD provider rates will increase by 3.2%. Starting July 1st, 2022, the DD provider rate model will be fully funded. This means the average DSP wage included in rate structures will go from $14.16 per hour to $17.28 per hour. In doing this investment, the legislature created a budget note to explain its intent as follows. It is the legislature's intent to fully fund provider rates for adult and children's group home services, day support services, employment services, attendant care, supported living, and non-medical transportation. This has been a short report read by Dina Wilder, the board operator.
Dear KBOO listeners, I would first like to say thank you to KBOO for giving a voice to those of us who do not have a voice. Please support them as they support us.
You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give.
That's the end of Disability Justice. Since we cannot be fully aware of everybody's difficulties within the community, we would really like it if you would send us your email, disabilityjustice@kboo.org.
Thank you. Did you miss the Soul and Hip Hop Marathon on Juneteenth weekend? No worries. You can go to kboo.fm/soul.